It was not intentional that we scheduled doing Ecclesiastes 3 on Memorial Day weekend. So we get to go right into a poem at the beginning that starts with birth and death and ends with war and peace. Anyway, it wasn't intentional, at least not our design. Anyway. So Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Most of chapter 3, which begins with a poem that's very familiar to most people, is a parallel, really, to the poem that's in chapter 1, and that starts out the whole thing, verses 4 through 11. And I'm not going to put that up on the screen, I just want to read it, because I think kind of letting that set our minds or set kind of the themes that are going on, you're going to see a lot of places in chapter 3 where it's looking back to that initial poem. Ecclesiastes 1:4, that's where I'm starting. Generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already in the ages, has been already in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after. I want to read that as kind of an introduction to this, to chapter 3 as we get into that, because chapter 3 has got a lot of things in it that are often taken out of context. And that's the theme. That's the whole start of what we are. You know, sets the theme and the mood for Ecclesiastes back there in chapter 1. We're going to get into this, and I'm going to try to point out some of those as I go this morning. So let's start out Ecclesiastes 3. Really had to cram it on the screen here. For everything there is a season, and every time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Thanks in no small part to Pete Seeger, who wrote a song based on this back in 1959, and it's very popular during the 60s and 70s. A lot of different artists did it. This is probably one of the better known pieces of Ecclesiastes. But I think it's important to note as you go read through this and you look at this that what's listed there is illustrative of human history. It's not a justification for any specific activity that's listed, which should caution us as to how much moral value we want to put on the words that are here. This is basically a description of human life. It's not a prescription for what has to be there. It just tells us what it is. It tells us what life under the sun is all about. The words translated season and time in the first part of this are synonyms that can be used interchangeably, and they are in some contexts. But it's the second word, time, or eth in Hebrew, that's repeated in the next seven verses again and again. season conveyed the, both of them convey the idea of an appointed time, a designated time for something to happen. And the word time itself kind of adds to that bigger meaning, that shared meaning, a passing of the years or the days. There are various matters in which these things happen and take place, the time it takes to do those and for them to go past and be done. Kohelet here, and Kohelet is the Hebrew word for Ecclesiastes. It's the term used for the person saying all these things. I get used to using that because of commentaries and things I've been reading, and I just fall into it, even though I may try to remember to say preacher or teacher, which is what most of the translations have. But Kohelet is what you'll hear this morning. Kohelet is not indulging in some kind of a philosophic discussion of time here. He's making this comprehensive statement on human life. You look at human life individually or generally, and you're going to see these kinds of things happening. The first line of the poem really brackets human life. Literally, it's giving a time to give birth and a time to die. And it kind of communicates the idea that for every child that's born, that child will also die someday. There are 14 lines in the poem, each repeating the word time ahead of a kind of a binary opposite. At least that's the idea that you get. There also appears to be some kind of relationship between pairs of two lines, and they're separated out that way in most of our English translations. The two lines that are together in a given verse share some things in common. At least that's one of the other possibilities you can look at with this. To kind of see this in a little more abrupt form or simple form, verse numbers. We got born and die, plant and uproot. Now, there's some parallels between those. Kill and heal, break down and build up. Weep and laugh, mourn and dance. Them fall together pretty well. Verse 5 changes up. You can see three of these have a, instead of a linear kind of, you know, lineup, they have a chiastic lineup. They cross. Scatter stones, gather stones, be at rest, turn away. Now, how does that go? Now, in the most of translation, in the translation I read, and a lot of them will say embracing and not, and refraining from embrace, or something like that. So, what that comes from, the words I've chosen here, is there's lots of debate about what scattering stones and gathering stones means. It's all over the place, actually. But I think one of the best things that I've heard, because this is a poem, so there's metaphors here. We're looking at things that are happening in common life and using them as metaphors for maybe bigger ideas or bigger pictures. But the idea of scattering stones and gathering stones may refer to the practice in ancient times in agriculture, where you'd go in, choose a field or select a field, and then you'd pull all the stones out of it. You gather them all. You bring them all out. And often those same stones were used then to make a boundary for the field, which is a practice that's continued way through the centuries, even after ancient times. And so the idea of scattering stones would be to say, okay, we're going to change now this boundary, or we're going to change the use of this piece of land. So the word embracing, or what's translating embracing in a lot of English translations, has a metaphorical use to it as well. Most of the time in the Old Testament, there's 13 Old Testament occurrences of the word, it's talking about embracing another person. But there is one use of this that's actually in the book of Ecclesiastes that's completely metaphorical. And it's in chapter 4, and it's saying embracing is a picture of folding your hands together, setting it in your lap, and doing nothing. And so in chapter 4, verse 5, it says, a fool folds his hands. He doesn't work. He does no work. He doesn't contribute anything. And so the idea then of unfolding them is communicates somewhat the same idea of this of the stones, where the scattering and the gathering change the purpose or the use of a thing, or how you're going to go about doing it. So that one, I think, that's one possibility. Don't take that as the final word. Anyway, we also have, makes more sense, search, quit searching, keep and discard, tear, sow, keep silent and speak. What's the relationship between sowing and speaking? Actually, I think that's another metaphorical thing, and we have some of those in our own language. You know, we talk about telling someone to be quiet, say, zip it. Or you talk about somebody who's really off on something and they're on a tear about this. Same idea. I think it's what we got going on there. And then the final one we have, love, hate, war, peace. I'm going to leave any more to those things, to your own time and your own efforts to kind of look into them, but those may give you some ideas for how to look at those in the future when you read them and see what kind of connections there might be. What's more important for this morning is that poem doesn't end and it doesn't exist by itself in a vacuum. It's set in a context, and the context is the book of Ecclesiastes, the same place that the poem we started with back in chapter 1. And the next three verses are very important to the context of what this poem has to say. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has put eternity in man's heart so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. There's some things in this passage here that I think are important for us to note. There's some clauses, some phrases in there. Beautiful in his time, eternity in the man's heart. Those are very common, very popular. But I want to look at what comes ahead of that. The question is asked. It's a rhetorical question that is asked at the end of the poem. It says, what gain does a worker have from his toil? Now, all the rhetorical questions in Ecclesiastes take a negative answer. Nothing. It just goes on and on and on. So the idea that gets across, I think, right away is that this poem, these words, are not necessarily here for comfort. They're here to describe a world in which has already been described as a vanity of vanities, as meaningless, as having no apparent purpose when you just confine yourself to life under the sun. The worker stands in for everyone who is living under heaven, to whom the words of the preceding poem apply. But the question was not about an economic gain or profit that we're talking about here. It's about, as one commentator put it, quote, the whole of life's activity in a cursed world where labor and life is subjected to a drudgingly irksome and fruitless efforts. Life is all about God's timing of things. We don't have much to say about it. We don't determine when we are born and when we die. We don't determine most of what goes on in our life, really. We just think we do. The question, what gain does the worker have from his toil, is really an echo from chapter 2. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils under the sun? And the answer for both of those is nothing. No gain, no profit. Now, the next sentence essentially repeats the last half of one of the lines in the poem in chapter 1. It is, and chapter 1 reads, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. It's almost word for word. This is a bridge between the poem You got the rhetorical question, the bridge of verse 10, between the poem and verse 11. And verse 11 is what has these two phrases that are very familiar to people. He has made everything beautiful in his time, and he has put eternity into man's heart. Now, one of the great things about Ecclesiastes, I think, it's my favorite Old Testament book. One of the great things about it is that it's all about disillusionment. I think that's good because, you know, it's not good to live with illusions. It's much, much more, you'd be much better off if you get rid of the illusions. Disillusionment is a good thing, although we think of it as a bad thing sometimes. And I'm here to disillusion you about these two phrases. They got to be in the top 10 of Old Testament verses taken out of context. But we need to keep them in context. And to help with that, I've put together, got the translation I read at the top there. The New Revised Standard Version has, he has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds. The bottom one is a New English Translation that says everything fit beautifully in its appropriate time, somewhat similar to the NRSV, and he has placed ignorance in the human heart. They're not quite so, not the kind of things you're going to put on a card, you know. These are not the kind of things that make a good bumper sticker, you know. But you know what? They're what Ecclesiastes says. The phrase, he has made everything beautiful in his time, may be appealing to us. It's nice to think about that idea. It's a nice sentiment. There may be some things somewhere, you know, in Scripture that you can find that might even support that. But the words everything and time connect this phrase to verse 1 and everything that's in this poem. Are we to infer that everything in the poem is beautiful? Death, killing, weeping, hate, war. There are 42 occurrences in the Hebrew Bible of the word translated beautiful. Predominantly, they speak of human appearance, especially that of women, and rightly are translated there beautiful. Although, the same words also used of Joseph and David and Absalom, usually it's translated handsome in those cases. But the same words also used of cows. So, you know, I don't know what you want to do with that part, but it does have a secondary meaning, and the meaning is proper, pertaining to what corresponds to an expectation. Now, that meaning is much more consistent with Ecclesiastes. What is our expectation? That's what the rhetorical question was about. What has the worker gained from life? And interestingly enough, in the English Standard Version, it shows up one other place in chapter 5, and there it's translated fitting. So why is it translated fitting there and beautiful in chapter 3? If you've ever talked to anybody, and I've had the privilege of doing this in a couple occasions, to have some conversations with people who actually have sat on these translation committees for English Bibles, one of the things that you'll find that they'll tell you, and usually off the record kind of situation, is that they'll come up with a translation that is fitting what is known of the text and the language and the information that we have about what that language meant at the time and what fits best in English, and they'll send it off to the editors, and it'll come back, and the editors leave it the way that it's always been, because that's what people want to hear, and they need to sell their Bibles. not the greatest motivation. But I'm here to disillusion you, remember? That's the whole point, what we're getting at. The second phrase in there has put eternity into man's heart. It's sometimes thought of as the equivalent of the residual knowledge or sense of the divine that we have, that Paul talks about in Romans 1. And I think it's interesting that where Paul talks about that, we got some themes from Ecclesiastes. So I'm going to look at those real quick. In Romans 1, he argues, for what can be known about God is plain to them, mankind, because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God, nor give him thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now, the point of what Paul's saying is futility here. That is true to the theme in Ecclesiastes. I mentioned this last week in Romans 8. For the creation is subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it. The idea of it being futile is, again, this sense of what Ecclesiastes is trying to get across. That if you're going to confine yourself, if you're not going to see anything or allow anything except what's under the sun, if you follow the science, you're going to end up with this kind of a view of life. You can't get anywhere else. There's nothing else to base it on. The idea of futility, I think in Paul's comments, were important. The idea of translating this as eternity is, again, another one of those places where that's what it's always said, so we want to leave it that way. That's what people are used to hearing. And I've heard sermons built on that word, that phrase, relying heavily on that word eternity, and bringing in or importing into the Hebrew text a whole bunch of concepts of eternity that never existed there. Now, the word's been used 3 times already in Ecclesiastes. The first 2 of them were in that opening poem. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Is there a thing in which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. And in chapter 2, for of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. So what the words comes out, that makes more sense. Using the word that way makes more sense. It carries the idea, the word in the Hebrew word carries the idea of a sense of a period of time, a long period of time. Could be in the past, could be in the future, could be both, but it just has to do with time. And it's not really, we don't have going on here some idea where we are trying to think about this, again, philosophically, about what time means and all those kinds of things. The point that Ecclesiastes, or Qohelet, is trying to make is that no matter how much time passes, as people, God has put in us a sense of that time. We have that sense of time as we walk through life. We have that sense of time when we think of history. We have that sense of time as we think toward the future, which we don't know anything about, actually. But we have this. And he's put this into the heart of man for the purpose of being sure that we have all the force of this endless cycles of things throughout the history of mankind is with us. Not the positive things, negative things as well. The past and the future are something that we know, we understand. And it weighs on us if you really stop and think about it. Now, this prompted the question about this benefit, you know, what profit does man get from the toil and his struggles? The sense of the passing of time that God has given us is for a particular purpose. But it's not a purpose we can appreciate. And it's in the last clause of verse 11, which you don't ever see on any kind of bumper stickers or cards or anything like that. So that he, mankind, cannot know what God has done from the beginning to the end. He wants us to be ignorant. Intentionally. We'll have this sense of time, past, future, present, but we won't have any, but we'll just be frustrated by understanding it. That's why some translators have suggested that the idea of ignorance or darkness may be inappropriate, may be appropriate in that spot. Now we're getting at what Kohelet is talking about. Which may be that maybe why he goes on then and kind of lifts it up a little bit. He doesn't want us to get too depressed and stop reading. We want to keep going. From the simile, he cannot find what God has done from beginning to end. He says, anyway, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, so that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. This is God's gift to man. We're going to come back to this because there's another one of these statements like this at the end of the chapter. But for right now, I want to just call your attention to one word, actually. In this translation, it's the word everyone. And it's really a phrase, the whole of man. And it's used four times in Ecclesiastes, and at least one significant commentator argues that this is the theme, this is the point we're trying to get at, the whole of man, all of mankind, not just the covenant people, not just Christians, everybody, everybody under the sun. And we'll see this again in chapter 5. Everyone, the whole of man, also to whom God has given wealth and possessions. In chapter 7, we'll see that it's the whole of man for whom the end is death. And most importantly, in chapter 12, we'll see as the summary to all of Ecclesiastes, part of the summary to Ecclesiastes, that the fear of God and keep the commandments is the whole of man. That's what that, the word duty is not there. The whole of man. Then Ecclesiastes goes on. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, so that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. And so that's my whole man thing. Okay, forgot about that. Sorry. I perceive that what God endures, that what God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. This is a lot of translations set this last part into poetry. The Lexham English Bible does this. Like, what is, it already was, and what will be, it already is, for God will do what he has done. Nothing can be added to what God does. Nothing can be taken away from it. It's a stark contrast to the world that we inhabit, yet when we look at what God is doing, if he's in charge of all these things, he's bending and moving all the whole of time and space toward a particular end, toward a goal. Now, what is that goal? Well, if you're just going to look for it under the sun, you're never going to find it. It just looks like it goes on forever. As believers, we have the advantage of knowing what that goal is, and that is we're going to take this world in which nothing can be straightened because it's all crooked, and we're going to make a new one. God's going to make a new one. But for Kohelet, for the Ecclesiastes, as you're reading it within its own context, we're not allowed to go there. We have to look at it for what it is. God has done this so that people will fear him. God in Kohelet, God in Ecclesiastes, is always kind of a God way out there. He talks about God a lot, but it's never in kind of this relational sense that we think of it. It's all this God that has set these things in motion and doing these things. We fear him. And that's a theme that we're going to see carried on through Ecclesiastes, this idea of fear. Often, interestingly enough, in the context of those passages, like we're going to look at again here, of the good things that we can have in life. But fear is an important part of this. Now this phrase up here, what is, already has been, or already was, and what will be, it already is. I don't think that Kohelet is trying to engage any kind of, again, philosophical observations of time. That's an interesting topic, time, because it's a creation, just like we are. It's a timeless God that created it. But I think what he's trying to point out is he's recalling, really, another statement from chapter 1. It says, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. The last phrase, chapter 15, up here it reads, for God will do what he has done, or God seeks what has been driven away, is very difficult. It's the most commentators just say, it's almost too, no one really knows what it means for sure. It has that whole phrase, that which is pursued is one word, and the word can be translated in this particular form, to be persecuted or hounded or to pass away. And you're going to see English translations vary a lot, and they kind of split on which way, one of those ways where they put it. So the possibility of the meaning of persecuted has led some commentators to see this as a phrase, as an introduction to Kohelet's next comments. So there is a connection there, possibly. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. Now, this is a complaint. It's the first of many complaints we're going to hear from Kohelet about the world under the sun. There's a lot of injustice, and we're going to see this often. He doesn't offer any resolutions for any of this, aside from the fact that God will judge the righteous and the wicked at some point, for which there will be a time for every matter and every work. Does that sound familiar? This is like a bookend to the first verse of chapter 3. This whole thing is the context of that poem. It signals a closing for all the considerations, at least in this point, for everything there is, a season, for every time, a matter under heaven. Interesting enough, that's the last time he uses the phrase under heaven, which is unique to Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. The idea of God's judgment, however, prompts another observation. It just gets better. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to the same one place. All are from the dust, and to the dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth. So we'll close in a word of prayer there and try to make it through the week. No, we won't. The phrase God is testing is another difficult one. It could be God is choosing. Again, you get lots of debate about which one that is. But the main point of that is very clear. They, mankind, that they may see that they themselves are beasts or animals. This observation has led some to accuse Qohelet of being an agnostic or a materialist in some sense, which completely out of step with Old Testament theology. But that's not a very good accusation. He just talked about the fear of God and the judgment of God. So there's obviously something that he's took that beyond that. And while he has deliberately chosen to limit his observations to under the sun, his underlying theology is really very much informed by the Old Testament. There's a whole book that's recently been published on this topic of how much of Ecclesiastes draws from the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Now, that's significant because Genesis 1 through 11, from the creation to the Tower of Babel, covers all that time before the choice of Abram and the beginning of a looking at a whole covenant people. So it's talking about the whole topic or the whole audience of Ecclesiastes, which is everybody, all mankind, ever. Now, you can see this even in some of the shared wording that this verse in Ecclesiastes has with some of the wording in Genesis. The idea of breath, we see in Genesis 1:30 that everything, you know, that has breath of life. We see in chapter 2 of Genesis, the Lord formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, just like we have in the breaths of life in the other creatures. In chapter 3, which of course is about the fall and the curse that results, the ground, because of your pain, you shall eat of it the days of your life, thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat of the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for your dust, and to dust you shall return. Makes this phrase, this verse in Ecclesiastes is a very accurate statement of what's going on. The rhetorical question of verse 21, who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit or breath of beasts goes down into the earth? What's the answer to all of his rhetorical questions? Nothing, no one, we can't know. If you're going to confine your view to under the sun, you're never going to know. We don't have any way that we can take what happens after death and test it in a repeatable laboratory experience or experiment. Our plausibility structures for our culture in particular lean that direction. And so we have trouble even accepting anything that isn't can't be that you can't prove that way. And Qohelet says, fine. Long way from when science came along, but he says, fine. Let's think of these things. What does that tell you about life? What do you really have? Well, what's the animal have? What's the beast have? Life, breath, death. After that, we don't know. He finishes up on a little more of an upbeat note with another one of these statements. So I saw that there is nothing better than that man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? So we'll go back and kind of take this up with verses 12 and 13 as well. It's the only way that I could come up with some of a positive way to end this discussion this morning. And so these are part of these carpe diem, seize the day passages. They're often what they're, even in the commentaries, they're spoken of that way. And there's seven of them, as I mentioned last week, in Ecclesiastes. We have two of them in chapter 3. One of them was in chapter 2. And so just to look at the first four of them together, you can see that there are some common threads here, some common ideas that get pulled back into this. This idea of eating and drinking, the idea of toil or work, the idea of things being from the hand of God, It's a gift of God. We saw in earlier in Ecclesiastes 3. You're to rejoice in these things. Rejoice in your work, your toil, your eating, your thinking. And then we have added now in this particular verse, verse 22, for that is his lot. Now, that's an important word we're going to see later, because you see all these now, even in the next one, or most of them, that they're going to show up again. They're going to show up again in the other three as well. But this idea of lot, in English, you talk about someone's lot in life. It's kind of negative in a way. It's almost like fate or destiny, kind of in that sense. But the word lot, I think, is better rendered here allotment or portion. This is something that God has given. God has apportioned or allotted to us for a particular purpose. It's something that we can, a resource we can draw on. So that, I think that gives a little more positive sense that way. So all of these have in them this comprehensive idea of eating, drinking, simple things, just keeping, sustaining life. Toil or work, often in the context, it's associated with doing good, the importance of doing good. Rejoicing in these things. A lot of these are really New Testament themes we ought to be able to think about. It's a gift of God. Our life is a gift of God. It's not ours. It's been given to us. And along with that has been given an allotment or a portion. Our place in this world, as huge as it is, whatever that happens to be, that's where God has put us. We don't always understand why or all that stuff, but this should help us not let this go to our heads, because it's not ours. We didn't accomplish it. God has done this. And so he wraps it up with another rhetorical question. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Well, if you're thinking just life under the sun, you don't want to spend too much time thinking what's going to be after you. Because it's nothing positive, nothing good, if that's all your life is. Just to kind of wrap this up, I'm going to kind of change gears just a little bit. Most of you may or may not know, this is Pentecost Sunday. If you follow any kind of liturgical calendars, it's Pentecost Sunday. And it's important because in the various festivals or, you know, observations of the liturgical calendar, liturgical year in the West anyway, this is the last big one that we have for a while. Because all of them encompass the life, the first coming of Jesus, the life of Christ. We'll pick this up again in Advent and Christmas and Epiphany and Lent and Easter and then Pentecost. Those are the festival times in the liturgical calendar. The term that's used for the rest of the time that we're in is ordinary time. Now, that has a very specific kind of theological meaning, but I think it's apropos to think about here. What has God given us? Ordinary stuff. Ordinary time. All of our time really is kind of ordinary in that sense. And I think there's a challenge here that we can take on, that how do we make the ordinary, the routine, the mundane, something that justifies God giving us this allotment, giving us this gift of life, giving us these simple things. And it has a lot to do with rejoicing. It has a lot to do with thanksgiving. Under the sun, God does not intend ever to give us an explanation of life. In fact, even what God has chosen to reveal to mankind will never provide a complete understanding of God's purposes. To pretend we know the reason for everything is to pretend to be God. When you hear someone who stands up as a spokesman for Christianity saying that, we know that this natural disaster happened because, take a few steps back, because lightning may be coming down. They're pretending to be God. And we can take that down even to the little things in our life. Why is what is happening, what will happen tomorrow, why will it happen? Because that's God's, that's our allotment in life. Do we understand why? All of it? No. And we never will. Because God hasn't given us what we need to figure all that out. He's God. We can never know it. He has given us life not to figure out those things, but he's given us life to live. And we need to live that in this very ordinary way, in this very simple way, that all these gifts and allotments that God has given to us, and we need to realize that it's in a world that is characterized by vanity. The hevelness we talked about from last week. In these, he expects us to rejoice and do good. We can never know what our little part in this life is going to be, what benefit it will have, where it really fits, even in the big pictures thing. I don't think we'll ever know, actually, because, again, we would have to be God to do that. But we are to keep living every day in the commonplace realities and try to bring our worship and our acknowledgement of God into those realities. They're a joy. They're a gift of God. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word, even the hard parts like Ecclesiastes. And we thank you for what you've given to us, for our allotments, the gifts, all those things in our lives. We thank you that you've made it clear through books like this that we don't want to embrace life only under the sun. We need to embrace something beyond that. And we thank you that you've provided that for us. And we pray that you'll help us to recognize that in the daily routines of our life. In Jesus' name.